Where were you born, miss?
Mrs.
The name is Vargas.
Hey, Jim! You see who's here?
Sure, Mr. Vargas.
Scott, have you seen Touch of Evil?
I've seen Touch of Evil upwards of maybe 10 times, going back over 45 years, directed by Orson Welles, one of my favorite Orson Welles films.
Oh, you've seen it a lot. I've seen it a few times. Yes, directed by Orson Welles. So right away, you know it's something special. Of course, Welles is most famous for the first film he directed in 1941, Citizen Kane, which changed movie history. And just like Citizen Kane, this movie was badly understood by the studio that produced it. It was Universal International. And then it was badly handled and mangled in editing and badly promoted. And just like Citizen Kane and his second film, The Magnificent Ambersons, it ended up being a box office flop. And just like Citizen Kane, it's now considered a great movie.
Not only is it considered a great movie, but the opening shot is one of the greatest shots in the history of cinema.
Yeah, that shot is iconic, right? Not just for what a great shot it is, but for its influence. You've seen The Player, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
Yeah, remember how that starts, right? The Player is this, it stars Tim Robbins. It's a Robert Altman film, and it's about, you know, kind of intrigue and a murder mystery, or it's not a mystery really, but a murder that happens among Hollywood executives. But the opening shot is this long one take, right? A long tracking camera moving around, following characters, no edits. And in it, these executives are actually even discussing the opening shot of Touch of Evil.
While they're paying homage to it.
Right. So, and I got to say, it's become completely overdone in movies now. It's very easy to do now, right? With the kind of equipment we have now, it's easy to do long, unbroken takes. There's some great ones, other famous ones. Scorsese has done some wonderful ones. There's one in Goodfellas. There's this amazing one in a boxing scene in Raging Bull. But now lots and lots of directors just show off and do these long 4-minute shots.
Or a film like Dunkirk, which it seems to be one unedited shot from beginning to end. It's not, but it seems to be.
Right. And sometimes it's done brilliantly. Like think about Birdman. Birdman has the illusion of being one unedited shot, but of course it's not. But do you want to describe it or should I describe it?
You should describe it.
Okay. So the opening shot of Touch of Evil begins with a close-up of some dynamite with a clock, an analog clock attached to it, and somebody setting this bomb. And then the camera pulls back, and we see them go to a trunk of a car, and the camera cranes way up high. And we see, you know, this. So now we're seeing a high-angle wide shot of someone putting this bomb into the trunk of a car. Then people, a couple, get into the car, start driving, and then over the period of about 3.5 minutes, which is how long this shot is, it's done on a crane, and it tracks through this entire border town. It's supposed to be the Mexican side of the border and then the American side of the border of a border town. It was actually shot in Venice, California, but it's shot on a location at night. So it follows this couple and the couple in the car. Then a couple comes into it walking, who are the leads in the movie, Janet Leigh and Charlton Heston. And it ends with them crossing the border into the United States. They kiss and then cut to the car exploding. There's a quick cut to the car exploding. Then a cut to the third shot of the movie after this, like, 1 second long shot of the car exploding. And that's another fairly long take done handheld of everyone running towards the explosion.
And then you find out that Charlton Heston he's a Mexican cop and he's a dignitary from Mexico. His wife is an American played by Janet Leigh. And that's the beginning of the plot, which is intertwining a U.S. police officer, detective played by Orson Welles. And then we meet the various characters that surround them, also the people that are suspects.
Right. So the quick outline of the plot is simple. The actual plot itself, if you watch this movie for the first time, you're going to be confused that it's kind of complex and confusing. Don't worry about it. Just watch it for the incredible style of it. That's what really what makes it great. But yeah, it's just this bomb goes off. The bomb was planted on the Mexican side of the border, where Charlton Heston would have some authority, and it blows up in this little border town on the American side of the border where Orson Welles is this corrupt sheriff. And so then it just becomes, first you think it's about tracking down who did the bomb, but then it turns out it also involves Charlton Heston's whole thing as he's trying to break this family of drug lords, and there's involvement on both sides, and it becomes very intriguing. Charlton Heston is he was really the power in this movie. Charlton Heston gets top billing. He had just done the Ten Commandments, directed by Cecil B. DeMille. So he was huge box office, right? As big as you can get in 1958. And Universal went to him to cast him in the role. And so he really had the most clout in the movie. And that's an interesting story. He's a mistake in casting, obviously. You would never cast an American actor to play a Mexican cop. So it kind of looks weird by today's standards. But Heston it was great because the story goes that they came to Heston and they said, will you do this movie? You know, you're going to be the lead. You're going to play this good cop. All we've got so far, we've got Orson Welles to play the sheriff. And Heston asked who was going to direct. And they said, well, we don't have a director yet. So Heston said, you got Orson Welles. Why don't you let him direct? You know, he's a pretty good director. So he had enough clout that he made sure Welles got the job. And when they apparently almost fired him at one point, Heston said, if he goes, I go. You know, actors knew what a great director Welles was, even if studios were afraid his movie would bomb. And really, I think Orson Welles steals the movie, don't you?
I do too. Yeah, I think he steals the movie. And before I talk about him in terms of his acting, it's interesting the story you just told. I'm picturing if some pedestrian journeyman director had gotten the job to direct the film, that it would have been this straightforward sort of whodunit detective film, that it would have looked like any movie ever, you know, that ever made in the studio system in the late 50s. And yet it becomes this Baroque German expressionistic influenced film noir with just this incredible artistic feel to it. And it becomes both, it's labyrinthian, not just in the plot, but also in the look of the film from beginning to end.
Absolutely. And I think the answer to your question, I think it's highly likely it would have just been an ordinary film, because they also then gave it, Welles then rewrote the script. So he's the writer and director on it.
And you know what, in terms of rewriting the script, the looking at the plot of the novel, it doesn't say anything about Mexico. So he made it the border town. He's the one that got a character like the Marlena Dietrich character into it. He's the one that made it what it is.
Yeah. And what it is, I mean, how do critics and film scholars look at this movie? In many, you know, sometimes people say it's the last true film noir, right? When people do this sort of, it's almost a cliche now, they say, well, the film noir started with the Maltese Falcon in 1941. Of course, you could pick a lot of movies, but it clearly started in the early 40s. And it ends, they'll say it ends with Touch of Evil. That's not entirely true either. There's a few more films in the late 50s and into the early 60s that you could say are still really part of the film noir movement. But what it does, the best thing I read about this was Paul Schrader, the very interesting, wonderful writer and director who's from Grand Rapids, Michigan, said that Touch of Evil is film noir's epitaph. It's like this movie, it's like Welles, it's like he looked at this movie and he said, I'm going to show the world everything, take film noir to its logical conclusion. I'm going to do all the tropes and all the plot twists and the look of it and take them to extremes. And so, yeah, the movie is just full of all these, you know, low angle shots, high contrast, wide angle shots of people's faces that are distorted. And
then just without giving any spoilers, how it concludes, the final moments on the Mexican side of the border around all of this almost ruined architecture and manufacturing equipment. That scene is, like you said, it feels like film noir's epitaph.
Yeah, it's like everything you can think of in film noir, he's just done in a way better than anyone else, but to such an extreme that the reason why I think he says it's the epitaph, or that other people have said it's sort of the crowning glory of noir, is that he's done so much with the high contrast, low key look, and just the style of it, and the extremes of the plot and characterization, that, and which, and I will add that they don't seem fake. It's just incredibly well done, right? But then after that, it's impossible to make a movie that it's kind of with that style without kind of being self-aware of it. And so all the movies that follow after that we would call noir or even neo-noir, they're kind of like meta movies, right? They're always, they're the movie they are, but at the same time, if they get into that noir style, you're like, well, yeah, it's kind of self-conscious.
Now, after having seen this so many times and watching it again recently to be able to talk about it with you, the one thing that really struck me this time is how great Orson Welles is as an actor. He is the best actor in the film. He does not even seem like it's 1958, but it also could be 2026. He is such a natural. The way that he plays Hank is just brilliant. And it also stands out because all of the actors around him are these classically trained actors who are acting. And he doesn't even seem like he's acting. That's how brilliant he is in this movie.
He is. And let's not forget, you know, of course, Welles is a very important figure as a director. I mean, he directed Citizen Kane. But he actually did tons of acting, not just in his own movies, but in other people's movies. When the American Film Institute in the late 90s did their list of the 25 greatest, what they consider to be the most important 25 actresses and 25 actors from the golden age of Hollywood, Welles was on that list. He did tons of great acting performances.
Why do I have to answer him? No, sir. I won't take back that badge until the people of this county vote it back.
And in this movie, I mean, it's one of his very best performances. I mean, he plays this at the time, you know, Orson Welles was a heavy man as he got older, but he actually wasn't that obese at the time he made this movie, but he made himself look much worse. He made himself look heavier. He made himself look, he used makeup and prosthetics to give himself sagging jowls and deep eye bags. And he's just like sweating and unshaven. And he limps with his cane, but he uses it as a weapon. He's increasingly out of control with drinking and viciously violent. And he's one of the most repellent movie characters ever. And in some sense, he was ahead of his time for just the graphicness of like a corrupt cop kind of character.
And everything you just said is correct, but the way that he talks is so understated. Like he presents himself, even when he's responding to the characters around him, whether he's agreeing with them or disagreeing with them, except for a few scenes where he raises his voice, he's always just cool as a cucumber.
I mean, I would just say he's a delight. It's a performance that's a delight to watch. It's just such an interesting performance.
And it starts with the first shot that you see him in as he pulls up in his car and the camera is down low and the door opens and he just, this massive figure just comes lumbering out of the car.
We haven't said anything about Janet Leigh. You know, Janet Leigh, who was in one of the other episodes we did on Act of Violence when she was younger, when she was just like 21. In this movie, I think she's still in her late 20s or something, but she's really good too.
Just a minute ago.
A minute ago, I said a lot of things, but now I think the best thing is to stick close to my husband, okay?
And people have pointed out it's kind of interesting because she plays, there's this scene in like a deserted hotel where she's victimized, and 2 years later, she's in Psycho. And the hotel manager in this movie is kind of like mentally deranged, and it's almost like, what was it about her, the roll of the dice, that she ended up first doing this movie and then doing Psycho?
Now, here's the thing. In terms of looking at it from a critical perspective from today, she's fine in the film, and so is Charlton Heston, but when I first saw this movie 45 years ago, immediately I thought the biggest flaw of this movie are those two characters. Not so much Janet Leigh, but mostly Charlton Heston.
Yeah,
because
that's
it's
fair.
Like, why is Moses playing this Mexican detective? You know, why is this white actor with the squarest of square jaws playing this Mexican detective? It just didn't fit. And it was also the least interesting. Their parts in the movie were the least interesting things for me at that time, I should say. At the time, the first time that I saw it, maybe the next few times. I've grown to appreciate them now after seeing it And after, you know, becoming more seasoned as a film watcher.
Yeah, I would disagree on Janet Leigh, because her scenes are pretty edgy and interesting.
Except that she is just so naive and innocent. That's where I just thought, you know, why are you crossing back over into the border? This is just shortly after the bomb goes off. Why are you following this obvious, looks like a juvenile delinquent, right back over the border just because the guy says, oh, I've got a note for your husband?
Yeah, I don't know. I think she's also kind of just interested in what is this intrigue that my husband as a law enforcement officer is involved in. She's naive that she doesn't realize how dangerous it's going to be. But I think you're definitely right about Charlton Heston. But of course, isn't that true in a lot of crime type movies? The straight, you know, good cop is the less interesting character.
Well, and again, this is not the in my recent viewing of this, I didn't really have the same reaction that I did 45 years ago.
Yeah.
So he's grown up. That part of the movie is something that I accept now. I looked at it as a major flaw. It's not really a flaw. It's just, like you say, if it's a flaw, it's sort of a flaw of the system at the time.
Yeah.
And how they make movies. Also talk about Marlene Dietrich.
Yeah. Wells said that the scenes with Marlene Dietrich were the best thing in the movie. And you could take all the Marlene Dietrich stuff out of the movie and it would still be the same movie. But I mean, or it'd still be, you wouldn't be losing any important plot points, but she's this character that he's known for years and he seems to be in love with her. He being the corrupt sheriff. It's the only time you see an actually like human side of him when he's with her. I think Wells wrote that when he was hired and then he got to write the script, he wrote in the scenes from Marlene Dietrich. They were old friends, and he just thought she was such an interesting actress that she could add to it. What do you think about the scenes?
Oh, yeah, I think they're brilliant. And in the fact that it's like this little sidebar to the whole movie that he enters, she owns a saloon and a restaurant and known for her chili. And it's on the Mexican side of the border. And when she first sees him, she doesn't recognize him. So apparently he looked completely different when he was younger.
Yeah, he's let himself go in a big way. She says you got to eat fewer candy bars. But there's one of the great lines in the movie. She's obviously some sort of fortune teller too, right? And she has these tarot cards. And Wells says he grabs the cards on the table and he's like, tell my fortune, you know? And she tells him, you know, I can't. Your future is all used up.
Come on, read my future for me.
You haven't got any.
And yeah, and that's towards the end of the film and she's right.
She's right, yeah. And she has the last line in the movie. Oh, one last thing about it, an interesting thing about it, is this movie, when it was released, was 95 minutes long, and there's an interesting story behind this, which is that Wells, you know, it had nothing but bad luck with American studios, and this ended up being the last movie he ever directed for an American studio. He was done with Hollywood permanently after this movie. After he directed it, he assumed he had final cut, he supervised the edit, worked with the editor, had a finished final cut done. But before they released it, he left to go work on another movie in Mexico. Big mistake. It wasn't released yet. The studio showed it as a preview and then decided they didn't like it and they cut it in a big way. The theatrical release, if you look on IMDb, this movie is listed as 95 minutes long. I checked for streaming, both Amazon and Apple, which are both renting it, 95 minutes long. I think they're all showing the original theatrical release. But it turned out when Wells saw them butchering his film, before they released it, he sent a 58-page memo to Universal International giving very clear, detailed instructions for how to re-edit the movie so it would be right. Of course, they never did it. But in the late 90s, a producer discovered this. He got involved with Jonathan Rosenbaum, who was a great film critic, who was a scholar of Wells. And they got Walter Murch, the great editor who, you know, was involved with Coppola and Lucas and people like that and Apocalypse Now. And they just followed his instructions. And so now if you find it, I mean, maybe you can find it streaming somewhere, but certainly on DVD and Blu-ray and so forth, you can find the 111-minute restored according to Wells' instructions version, which Janet Leigh and Janet Leigh and Charlton Heston were still alive in the late 90s, and they loved it, and they said, this is the movie Wells intended. But even if you can't find it, just watch the theatrical release.
Either one is worth seeing.
Yes, absolutely. Thanks, Scott.
Thank you.